Welcome to Unemployed Workers Fight Back.
Join your hosts Anne
and Kevin, that's me,
the second and fourth Friday of each month on The Sewer Show.
Between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m.
Here on 3CR Community Radio.
This is a show where we explore macroeconomic solutions
for the unemployed and underemployed.
Everyone in our community has value. Welcome to Unemployed Workers Fight Back. Anne, how are you doing?
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm shaking off the last bit of a head cold, and it's just a head cold. I did my RAT test, and it's all good.
I will be in the same room as you.
Yes.
And I'd like to welcome Larry and Larissa into the room too.
Excellent.
Thank you for joining us for another hour of looking at just what our currency issuing government gets up to when they've got the power of the purse.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that talk been going on just recently. There's been talk from the Reserve Bank deputy. What was her name? Michelle? Oh, I should remember. I'll come to it later on.
She's the deputy of the central bank in Australia, is she?
Michelle Bullock. She's been talking a bit recently. She's had some very interesting things to say, which has been kind of a where we finished off the last show, Anne, was we were talking about all sorts of stuff. We're talking about the macro economy and about. Mm-hmm. It sort of gets confusing, and what we were going to talk about was the job guarantee, and
we didn't get there last time.
We didn't. And so I guess what we should do is that some of our listeners will be very familiar with what we say when we refer to the job guarantee, but we should explain to some of our more recent listeners what this whole scheme is. Mm. And once you have an understanding of how the job guarantee works, the main handbrake on this and any other decent social policy is this fear of debt and deficit. Mm. So everything that we discuss about economically progressive policies drags around this unnecessary anchor of debt and deficit. People are always scared that how can we afford this and how can we afford that? So
can I remind ourselves what this debt and deficit scaremongering sounds like?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Debt. Default. Mortgaging the future. Debt. Debt. Default. Mortgaging the future. Mortgaging. Mortgaging. Mortgaging the future. The future.
Was that that defunct? What was that guy's name?
Who was that fellow?
He won an election. Tony bloody Abbott, yeah. And he came in on this whole thing about, debt and deficit was going to wipe out our future and it's going to be a burden for our children and our children's children, etc. Then the same government, Tony Abbott, led to Malcolm Turnbull, led to, who's that last guy we had? I'm so glad to forget these people's names, Scott Morrison. They are so forgettable. Mm. So the whole thing was what we saw through that was a government that was elected on the basis that debt and deficit was going to ruin the world and we're all going to die, left in the same party, the coalition party, the whole way through. The deficit had ballooned in some sort of magnitude that's never been in Australia before. Now, by Tony Abbott's own rationale, we should be a basket case and a disaster. And yet we had Scott Morrison and the rest of the coalition telling us that they had AAA credit ratings from all the agencies and that the debt to GDP ratio was in good health. So what do we learn from this?
Yes.
That debt and deficit is bullshit, okay? It just they talk about it, but the reality is the practical experience of debt and deficit is that it doesn't matter.
Right. You get a lot of mixed messages or contradictory messages about the debt and deficit coming out of the central bank. So like with the deputy that you were referring to before, I think sometimes they will say that the central bank can create money by keystrokes, by typing numbers into computers, and therefore we don't have to worry about paying back any kind of a debt. And then other times they seem to worry about it.
Yeah, well, okay. So if you read any of Bill Mitchell's blogs just recently, he touched on this as well. So we had Michelle Bullock, who is the RBA deputy governor. And she made this comment, which I was reading in the Financial Review from the I've got here the 23rd of September, but isn't today the 23rd of September?
Mm.
So this is from a couple of days ago. It might have been yesterday. It says, if any commercial entity had negative equity, assets would be insufficient to meet liabilities and therefore the company would not be a going concern.
Translation
is, if any commercial entity had negative equity means that if you had a business that was failing,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't have assets to meet your liabilities, to pay people, etc.
So your liabilities are like your debts.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
You're going to fold. If you're a commercial entity and you can't afford to run, you fold, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Bullock
said. I'd agree with that.
Yep.
So far, so good.
That's good, Ms. Bullock said, before adding that different rules apply to central banks that can create money.
Uh-huh.
And that the ability for it to do its job was unaffected. So what?
The central bank is unaffected by having liabilities on its balance sheet because it can create the money.
The Reserve Bank of Australia can run in debt. That's what she says here. She says, before adding that different rules apply to central banks that can create money. That's the Reserve Bank of Australia and the US Fed and the Japanese yen-making machine, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
And that the ability for it to do its job was unaffected. So if a Reserve Bank of Australia, if a currency-issuing Bank of Australia or the US or anywhere else is running at a loss, the ability for it to do its job was unaffected. Debt and deficit does not matter. It can still create currency as required. It doesn't need to raise funds other than to create funds because it's the currency creator.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
So a lot of this discussion I have discovered, jumping into this world of macroeconomics, a lot of the discussion around macroeconomics does get very confusing and very murky because you hear different things coming out of the mouths of sometimes the same person. And I'll just let you know about this. I had a chat the other day with one of our MMTers, one of our fellow amateur MMTers by the name of Darren.
Right.
Darren, hello, if you're listening.
I hope he is.
And he was pointing out to me that when somebody comes along, either an economist or like one of those mainstream pundits, and they say something like, the government needs to fund its spending. The government needs to fund its spending. He was saying, well, sometimes people are using just one word like fund in different ways. So sometimes somebody might be saying, well, the government needs to find the money to do the spending. And of course, you and I would heartily disagree with that because we know the government has no trouble finding the money. Because
well, they do need to find the money. It's in the Reserve Bank of Australia. They just say, can you guys clock up another $1 trillion and we're all sweet.
That's right. It's in the fingers of the person yeah. sitting at the Reserve Bank of Australia.
They just say, have you done everything right? Have you checked all the right boxes? And when they say yes, they go, done.
Yeah. So there's a very careful process around it, but it's not like they have to go to China with their hat in their hands or anything. And then sometimes when somebody says, the government needs to fund its spending, sometimes what they're saying is the government needs to create what they call the fiscal space in order to do the spending. And all that means is that the government needs to make sure that it won't cause inflation by doing the spending. And we would agree with that.
Yes.
So why these discussions get very confusing because you can use the same word in different ways and people don't always say what they mean when they're talking about it.
So let's give a practical example of where the government could spend into the economy and cause inflation. If there's a lot of building going on in the private sector and the government decides that it also wants to build a lot of social housing at the same time, it's competing with the private sector for resources of labour and materials. That will push prices up because there's a shortage. So, mm-hmm.
And in fact, sometimes people, when they say the government needs to fund its spending, what they're thinking about are those resources. And what they really mean is the government needs to make sure it's got the resources before it does the spending.
So the resources are always need to be considered far more importantly than the money. The money is mm-hmm. always there. Mm-hmm. It's a question of applying the money, government funding, to what resources are available. And you'll hear this time and time again in any sensible economic conversation.
That's right. And speaking of sensible economic conversations, what I got to thinking after talking to Darren about how we can use this word funding in so many different ways is I was thinking what we are lacking in our society is a common language to talk about how the economy works. And this is why we get tangled up in so many knots, and this is why, you know, there's so much conflict around these kind of discussions.
A lot of it does come back to language. You know, the whole, we've had this conversation before where I've said we're not going to use the term debt and deficit anymore. We're going to call it a government contribution to the economy, because that's exactly what it is. That's what they've been doing for decades and hundreds of years. And the government spends into the economy. It's transferred from the public sector, being the government, to the private sector. Mm-hmm. So when it runs a deficit, that becomes a private sector surplus. We like that, okay? So that's all good.
Yeah, so how you use the language is really important, but we don't actually get educated. I was thinking, you know, in primary school or secondary school, we don't have any kind of a public education where we can all be on the same page and have the discussion. And I was thinking it'd be kind of like if we only had one word for water, like we have one word for money. And can you imagine, like, if we had no word for water that's up in the sky? So we had no word for clouds.
Right.
And then no word for, like, the water that
rain,
comes.
Rain, steam,
yeah,
humidity.
Yeah, we had no water for when it land. No word for when it lands on the ground. So
ice,
no lake, no yeah. lakes, no, no lakes, billabongs.
No seas, no creeks. It's just water. Water, yeah. water, water.
So
water.
If, you know, if you're going to have a shower, you'd
that
have
could,
to say.
That could be easier.
I'm going to go into the room where the water comes out of the tap and stand under the water, because I wouldn't be able to say I'm going to have a shower.
Right.
And that's about the level of public discussion we have with the economy, because nobody understands what money is and how it changes depending on where it is and what it's doing and who's doing it and where it's come from.
And what you and I have learned is that it's actually not that complicated. Money in, money out. Where's it come from? Where's it go? And it can get complicated, like everything can get complicated.
Well, the economists do have different words, but they don't agree on it. So, for example, I'll just give you a sense of what these different words are. They talk about money as deposits. They talk about it as vault cash. They talk about base money. They talk about reserves. They talk about
M0, M1, M2, M3,
yep,
M4.
They talk about government debt, private debt, public debt. And all of this just is money, but you really want to understand what each of those is in order to understand how the economy works.
Anyway, we've sidetracked, Anne. What we're trying to explain is that debt and deficit doesn't matter. We know that because the coalition was huge on about it, and even they decided with the end of Scott Morrison that debt and deficit didn't matter, because if it did, then they should have committed hari-kari. You know, they would have gone, oh. And we've got people in the Reserve Bank saying that debt and deficit doesn't matter. So this is not just you and me saying this.
No.
These are all the critics of this stuff agree with us that debt and deficit doesn't matter. If it did matter... Mm. Like, we've been in debt forever. What happened after World War II? We're in massive debt. I mean, then was followed by the golden years. Like, so it doesn't matter. So if you understand that debt and deficit doesn't matter and that your main concern is inflation, which is to say if the government injects currency into the economy, is it going to cause inflation or not? That's the main concern of macroeconomics.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've explained, if the government went on a big public housing build at the same time that the private sector was going off and there was a shortage of labour and materials, it would create inflation.
I did hear the other day somebody said that most central bankers, anyone who's connected to a central bank anywhere around the world, often when you talk to them, they'll all quietly agree that they don't have to go digging for gold in order to get the money. They'll all quietly agree that they're actually creating it.
That's what a fiat currency is. So that means we can talk about the job guarantee, which is what we want to do. But
can we do that maybe after a song?
Yeah. Now I'm going to make a request here, Anne.
Oh, okay.
You're hearing it here first. Actually, second, PBS played this the other night. But there's a band, new band come up called Phil and the Tiles. Now, I've actually played, Reef is the guy at front of this band, and I've played some of his stuff on this station before a little while ago. But they're just coming up with a whole bunch of new material, and they're pretty hot. I may be related to somebody in that band, full disclosure.
We might hear the story afterwards, huh?
We might have, but regardless of that, like, you make your own minds up. I reckon this – I've been looking for a band post-COVID that is a bit new and fresh, and I reckon this could be filling the tiles with their song, Nun's Dream.
Listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet, www.3cr.org.au.
Yeah, so that was Nun's Dream by Phil and the Tiles. Keep your eye out for them. I reckon they're going to do okay. I like him anyway. I don't care if anybody else likes him. I like him.
You're not going to reveal your connection?
No. No, that would be...
Just let the listeners make up their own minds.
If I told listeners that that my boy was playing guitar in that band, they'd think it was just pure nepotism. So I won't be saying that, Anne.
All right, we won't mention that.
Or that I might have been the team manager for the St Bede's Mentone footy team, which the bass player was also in. But I'm not going to talk about that either.
Put you in charge of the central bank, Kevin.
Good. Okay, job guarantee. So we go over this now. Job guarantee is this scheme that Bill Mitchell devised. Now, it may have been devised independently somewhere else.
It's had a few versions, I think. It was known as the Transition Job by Warren Mosler.
Rightio.
Who also helped create the MMT story. And I think there was also the employer of last resort idea from Hyman Minsky.
Right. Yeah. So it's got a few variations. Bill's not the only person to have thought of that, but Bill has championed this for a very long time.
And he's understood how it works as this is a technical term, as a buffer stock, but we won't go into
that. Yeah, he's explored it back to front. So essentially, we pay unemployment benefits to people who are unemployed. We should pay twice what we're paying so that they're living at the poverty level, not half the poverty level as a very, very minimum. And so we accept that we have a social responsibility for those who are finding it hard to find work, as we should. That's kind of like looking after unemployed. But what the job guarantee is it says we'll provide work to anybody who wants work, anybody who's unemployed and looking for work. The government will find them work and pay them at the minimum wage. Flat rate, there's no scale to this. It's the minimum wage, which we reckon is about 45 grand a year or thereabouts.
Somewhere around there.
Okay, yep. So, but, you know, that's a figure that other people can sort out. But, you know, we're talking about, what's 45 grand? That's less than a grand a week. You're talking about...
It's more than double the current unemployment rate.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, so it's about $800 or $900 a week, minimum wage. And people go, well, how can you afford to do that? Well, you don't have to worry about the debt and deficit, remember? We had that conversation. So you don't worry about how you're going to afford to pay for it. Mm-hmm. You just pay for it. So then what are the benefits of that? The benefits are that you have people employed, people contributing to the economy, because once they're employed, they can buy cars, fridges, rent houses, do all that sort of stuff.
So people have access into the economy through earning money.
So they're stimulating the economy. They're no longer a drag on the economy because they're not getting paid to do nothing, which is what you've done, what you do when you're unemployed. They're getting paid to do something. So something.
I think I might object to the idea of being a drag. I don't think anyone is a drag on the economy, but I do think the way the economy gets managed with unemployment can contribute to things like lowering the overall productivity.
I'd say that the current arrangement with unemployment is meant to put a drag on society. Like that we use.
So we're not talking about individuals being a drag. We're talking about the whole phenomenon of unemployment.
Yeah, unemployment is used as a way of putting downward pressure on wages by having this pool of unemployed there ready to take your job so that you don't get too antsy and start asking for a pay rise. Mm-hmm. That's what it's used for. They mm-hmm. say it's anti-inflationary, but it's not. It's there to suppress wages and make sure the business can increase their profits.
Right.
So that's the current arrangement. So it would relieve that very nasty element to the way things currently mm-hmm. are.
And it would relieve job guarantee. What we're doing is we're relieving poverty. So we're relieving all the ills that come with poverty,
yep.
including child poverty, which is such a terrible thing. I think we've got 1 in 6 children in Australia in poverty. What does that mean? That means that you're living with the stress of your parents. You're living in a household where there could be a lot of conflict. You're moving a lot. You're not staying in the same school. You lose your friends. Maybe you can't keep your pets because you've had to move. It's very stressful on children to be in poverty.
Yeah. And these things all end up costing as well, because you end up with mental health issues. You end up with substance abuse issues. You end up with people trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And that often means doing things that run against the law.
Yes.
And that all costs. So some of these people might end up on the wrong side of the law. You've then got to house them in a prison. That's a lot more expensive than
It's very costly to run unemployment. And even more than that, what we understand with modern monetary theory is that it's entirely unnecessary.
Yeah, so you replace all of the negatives and you give somebody a job. What sort of job? There's been a lot of talk about this, but it's supposed to be run at a local level where we're talking about things like people assisting with aged care, people helping to regenerate the environment, plant trees.
And the nice thing about it is it doesn't matter where you are. You can be in the city, you can be in a rural area, you don't have to move from where you are. You can be in a remote community where there are no employers or very few. You can have the job guarantee wherever you are, and you can be contributing to your community through that job wherever you are.
Yeah, and the other important thing to note is that this is voluntary. It's not like work for the dole where you have to do it.
Mm.
You can choose to do this or not. Now, if you don't do it, that's a whole other conversation. There's quite a few of those conversations, and we can have that another day. But we're talking about what the job guarantee is, and it's this idea that the government will provide employment to anybody who wants work. At the minimum wage, it will be organised locally through local councils, etc. It might be that you're an unemployed surfy bum. Well, no, you're not anymore. Now you're a beach patrol person who is making sure that the place is kept tidy, and you're keeping an eye out for people swimming, making sure that they're not in trouble. We'll pay you to do that. Why not? You know, like it needs to be done.
I think the the ideal version that we certainly have of a job guarantee is the person involved gets to negotiate with the job guarantee office what would be suitable work for them to do.
Yeah. So with all of the savings that you make from not paying unemployment benefits and all of the associated costs with forcing people into living on half the poverty line, if you're talking about the economic rationalism, how can you afford it? Well, for the economic rationalists, it's going to stack up pretty well anyway. Mm. But as we keep on reminding, we don't have to worry about that. Debt and deficit does not matter. And if you want a practical example of what this looks like, it's pretty much what Australia did after World War II.
Mm.
We ran this was part of the H.C. Coombs employment paper.
Ooh, this is Kevin doing his research, everyone.
Yeah, and I actually read something. This is something unusual because Anne does all the reading normally. And so I'm just going to go through this a bit. I wrote down some notes and I've forgotten what I wrote because it was a couple of weeks ago.
Can't wait to hear.
Okay, so the 1945 Full Employment White Paper by H.C. Coombs, Nugget Coombs, I think was his name. And so it runs that between 1919 and 1939, there was an average of 10% unemployment. And during the Depression, that got up to 25%. Okay, so then what happened was we had World War II, and World War II, there was no unemployment.
Lo and behold,
everybody was put to work. They were either fighting in the army, or if they're back at home, they were making stuff.
And how did they get that sudden full employment, Kevin? Well, how on earth did that happen? The government did some spending.
And what happened after World War II? Did we go, because we'd spent all this money, did Australia go down
the
gutter?
Plug hole?
No, we had the golden years of the 50s and the 60s, okay? So we had no unemployment. Well, this got some of the Labor politicians thinking. They go, hang on, if the government intervenes and makes everybody useful in some sort of capacity, it's as much to do with the money as it is to be being part of a society. And this is very much core to a lot of conversations, especially with the libertarian stuff that's been going on recently. It's important to be part of your community and working, doing something that you feel is valuable, that adds value to society, is good for your mental health as anything else. And to be rewarded with a basic wage for that is good as well. It generates a lot of goodwill. So, for instance, after World War II, when a lot of the European migrants came out, they were put to work, and we're talking particularly, say, the Italian migrants, immigrants, and a lot of – oh, look, there's a whole bunch of European immigrants who came out here. They worked, and they bought houses, and they became part of the community, and they felt like they belonged because they contributed. So it's part of that whole ethos. So anyway – so in peacetime, it says, I'm just going to read from my notes and I've forgotten what I've written, so just bear with me. In peacetime, it is the responsibility of the Commonwealth and the state governments to provide the general framework of a full employment economy. This was the objective of the white paper. So they've seen it during wartime. And so what they're saying now, in peacetime, it is the responsibility of Commonwealth and state governments to provide the general framework of a full employment economy. So this is where we went after World War II. So if you talk about this job guarantee and you think that, oh, wow, it's pretty fanciful. No, it's not. It's been done before.
So we had a full employment economy pretty much, didn't we? So that meant that we had less than 2% unemployment, and that 2% was usually what they call frictional unemployed, which means people between jobs or people who've just left studies or something. So it wasn't long-term unemployed. And I love the story about New Zealand also had a full employment economy just after the war. And there's a great story about how there was less than, I think, 1,500 unemployed people in New Zealand. And the minister, the employment minister, knew them all by name.
Yes, it's a very different world. So you wonder how we got from where we were to where we are now. And
I can tell you they didn't mention the job guarantee in the job summit recently.
Well, yeah, this was the point, as we were talking about this job summit. So this is, it seems to have gone off the news, and we should have talked about this the last show a couple of weeks ago because it was hot then. But the whole job summit stuff, they're talking about how to create jobs, essentially. That's what a job summit's about. And we haven't had one since the 80s and 90s. This is something that the Labor governments do.
Okay. And so tell me about the previous ones.
Okay. So this is from Alan Kohler. And he said, Alan Kohler on the job summit, he said the 80s and 90s delivered wage restraint. And that was done as a trade-off with superannuation. They said, and there's a fair amount of criticism about that too. There's a lot of.
Yes, I could tell you a few things about super, but anyway.
A lot of lefties feel it was a bit of a sellout. Okay, and yeah, I can see that. Look, I think the thing with the wage restraint, the superannuation, it might have worked had Keating been Prime Minister for the rest of his life, for the rest of our lives, and handed over to like-minded people. But the framework he set up when it was handed over to Howard
got twisted,
got exploited. So it was very much a goodwill thing. Anyway, so the 80s and 90s delivered wage restraint, expansion of health, education and superannuation, as we just said. Now, I don't understand this, but bear with me. Reduced preferential taxation of capital income. Okay, we'll come back to that some other time.
I can't help you there, Kevin.
Okay. While lowering marginal income tax rates and removing most industry protection. So we saw tariffs disagree, and we're beginning to see the international trade, the free trade sort of stuff.
So what we're talking about is the 1980s version of the Job Summit.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not really left-wing radical agenda here, is it? It's pretty...
No, it's pretty centre-centre-right, maybe.
Yeah. Now, Alan Cole then goes on to say that since then, two alternative ideas have dominated. One, that a pool of unemployed is needed to keep wages and inflation under control, and that's what we know as the NIRO. They say it's to keep wages and inflation under control. A true statement would be is that a pool of unemployed is needed to keep wages under control.
Right.
Nothing to do with inflation, because if you keep
inflation's the veil, isn't
if you
it?
Keep wages under control, they pretend that the that keeping wages under control will keep inflation under control. But what it really does is maximise profits for business, which makes rich people richer. Mm. And so, with the idea of that, we saw flat wage growth and increasing profits. So
That's what the last job summit gave us.
he said that wasn't part of the job summit back then. He said since then two alternatives So this has been the introduction. This is more of the Howard interpretation of what to do with the job summit than anything else. Mm-hmm. And it says number two, that government cannot take responsibility for anything beyond defence and should leave it all to the markets.
Oh, there's a familiar refrain.
Which is basically neoliberalism 101, you know.
It is, isn't it? I was thinking, you know, having the Labor government back in power, I just have this sense of relief that there's someone in government now who thinks that the job of government is to govern. It's just a nice thing. Even though you might disagree with a few things that they're doing, at least they think that government ought to govern, and it's not just about protecting property rights.
Well, look, one thing we know about the Labor Party is that they're captured by neoliberalism, but they don't... I think any government around the world, neoliberalism has become the norm, and you have to dance to that tune to some degree if you don't want to be seen to be radical, crazy lefties like the Greens or something, you know. So you have to pretend that you enjoy neoliberalism and that it's true, and so they do to some degree. But I was very happy to hear Tony Burke addressing issues about the gig economy, about trying to get minimum wage and some other protections into the gig economy, because the gig economy was essentially it's the third welding of our jobs.
Well, I had a bit of a talk recently with one of our favourite MMT economists, Professor Phil Lawn at Torrens University in Adelaide, and we'll hear more from him in a future show.
Sure.
But he did just mention a little bit about the job summit, which here.
There's this job summit, which is interesting because it shouldn't be a jobs summit. It should be a training and education summit.
Mm.
The problem is not that there are not enough people to take up jobs. We know there's about 1.3 million Australians who are either unemployed or underemployed. The problem is we have huge labour supply and skills mismatches, supply and demand mismatches, because our education and training systems have just failed us.
Mm.
We don't need to have people emigrating from overseas in order to fill gaps.
The whole skills shortage sort of mythology that's going on.
No, but there is a skills shortage. There is a skills shortage, but there's not a labour shortage.
Okay.
That's a completely different thing. And so we have a lot of people who are trained to do jobs where those jobs aren't on offer. And we have a lot of jobs, then there aren't people suitably trained. That's the problem.
You're listening to Unemployed Workers Fight Back,
a show all about the economics and experience
of unemployment and underemployment
here on 3CR Community Radio.
Yeah, so it's interesting that whole migration thing. It's can become quite divisive, and the rest of it. Migration has been used to increase GDP to make debt appear smaller.
It's the easy way to do it.
Yeah, and I think
Junk food. It's like taking too much sugar if you're hungry.
Yeah, I reckon I don't have anything to back this up other than my own thoughts. Is that I think the coalition deliberately de-skilled the Australian workforce so that it could utilise an overseas workforce to put downward pressure on wages and to keep the Australian workforce vulnerable.
Mm. Well, we did a bit of a show on the use of immigrant labour, and I was very pleased to see with the Job Summit. One thing I did like about what they're doing is they're talking about permanent skilled migration versus temporary unskilled migration. And when the Howard era was tweaking the visas, they did this emphasis on temporary unskilled, And that's where you end up with an exploited workforce in the form of this thing known as a guest worker state.
Yeah, yeah, pushing prices down and the rest of it.
I really like their emphasis on doing skilled permanent migration, which is going back to what you were talking about, Kevin, with the Italian immigration after the war, where you were inviting people in to become part of your society. You weren't saying, come over here, let's exploit you and then we'll kick you out again.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, come and help build our society. And we're multicultural and we're on stolen land. We always need to remember that. So there's that whole context, another conversation. Now, one thing, I was listening as I was working the other day, putting in a kitchen, I heard a ComSec spokesperson. This is on the 1st of September.
ComSec.
ComSec is the like the shares investment part of the Commonwealth Bank.
Okay, Commonwealth Bank.
So right. A ComSec spokesperson on the ABC News stream on the 1st of September said, it's not up to business to manage wage rises. That's the government's responsibility.
We should hold them to that.
Oh boy, oh boy. And then by the same token, we've got Alan Kohler saying that government cannot take responsibility for anything beyond defence and should leave it all to the markets.
That's the libertarian or the, yeah. The...
Yeah, so they want to have it both ways. They want to say, listen, business is there just to chase profits. That's what we're there for. It's not up to us to regulate the labour market. We just need to maximise profits as much as we possibly can. That's all we have to concentrate on. The government should look after that. But in the same breath, I'll go, but the government should only really be looking after defence and leave everything to the markets, which basically
they
just...
They want it both ways.
Yeah, they're setting up a platform to exploit workers and drive prices down. They hide it under the banner of being anti-inflationary, but really it's just profit-driven. Mm. It's just greed. So that's not very good. Where are we up to?
I was thinking about what Phil Lorne was saying back there about how we have a skills shortage. We do not have a labour shortage, which means we've got plenty of people who want more work in Australia, but we can't match them up with the jobs. And part of the reason for that is because we've spent decades undermining our education system here, including almost completely gutting the TAFE system. So I really like that the Job Summit included a bit of funding for TAFE to actually have free courses, free education.
Which we desperately need. You know, do you remember when the Liberal government stopped supporting the automotive industry and Holden and Ford and Toyota all closed down?
Mm-hmm.
One of the main reasons for that was because they don't like organised labour. They don't like unionised labour. Mm. They were happy to see all those industries go because they were strong unions.
Unions got attacked from all different sides, didn't they?
Yeah. So, what I suspect is that the Conservative governments aren't interested in local training, etc., because local skilled people organise and then they start getting a power base. And that's exactly what...
I never thought about that as the reason for attacking the TAFE sector.
Yeah, this is what I reckon they're deliberately de-skilling the Australian workforce to make them vulnerable, making up for that shortage by importing labour and then booting them out when they don't want them anymore.
Oh my gosh, they're just more evil than even I thought they
were. Oh no, they're very evil. Never underestimate how evil these...
Got me worried, Kevin.
Yeah, no, they're very evil. So, and one of the interesting things about that Jobs Summit was that... What's the current leader of the opposition? See, I love the fact that I forget the evil one. You know,
Dutton.
So Dutton didn't. Dutton didn't turn up to the job summit.
We're going off script here, Kevin.
No, we will. Do we have a script? So he didn't turn up, which means he's just not interested in any sort of organised labour concept, be it a job summit, a union or whatever.
No, didn't even show up, did he?
No, which he thought was a big statement saying that, I'm not going to be in the same room as unions, but basically just says, I'm irrelevant.
One of the headline ideas that came out of the job summit that I came across, and I thought, that's a really weird one. How did that happen? I'll just tell you what it was. It was that it would relax the rules so that seniors can work extra hours without losing their pension entitlements with a one-off income credit of over $4,000 this financial year. And I thought, I was just imagining that they're going to wheel out all these bent-over greyheads to come and wash our cars and serve us coffee and all sorts of things,
yeah,
which would actually look quite like America because I lived there for a few years, and I remember being so surprised, and a lot of people would comment on this, about how you'd see a lot of older people doing things like being checkout chicks and stuff.
Do you reckon that's like a reserve army of desperate people that they can call upon? Like, you squash your unemployed to keep wages down, but if you really need to wheel out people, don't get the unemployed to do those jobs. Wheel out your semi-impoverished aged population instead, exactly. Who are a little bit lean, a little bit hungry.
I used to think, this person should not be carrying my bags. I should be carrying them for them.
Yeah, gee, you know.
But anyway, then I heard that this was actually a leftover coalition idea, which made sense to me.
Yeah. That kind of does, yeah.
Are we ready for a break?
I'm ready for a break. Sometimes my brain's not functioning very well. I reckon a song would be good. Now, you got anything in mind by any chance there?
I do. I'm going to choose a mellow one this time.
Oh, okay, right, yeah. I thought the last one was mellow.
On digital and on the internet, www.3cr.org.au.
Ross House has community meeting rooms available for hire at subsidised rates. Perfect for small meetings, student study groups, Zoom conferencing and seminars. Facilities include free Wi-Fi, display screens for presentations, projector and sound system and a Zoom conferencing system. HEPA filter units have been placed in every meeting room. You can book and pay via their website, rosshouse.org.au, or contact reception during office hours on 9650 1599. Ross House is a 3CR supporter.
No crime, no time. Fix Victoria's bail laws now.
Prisons are bursting at the seams with poor people. ISTJA Melbourne is calling on the Victorian government to release unsentenced people on remand from Victorian prisons. First Nations people are 3% of the population, yet represent 29% of the general prison population.
89% of First Nations women entering prison are unsentenced.
ISTJA Melbourne is asking you to sign the No Crime, No Time petition,
which can be found on ISTJA Melbourne's Facebook page.
Indigenous Social Justice Association Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Hey, that was a lovely song, Anne. That was Holly Heeb with her song Sync.
It's one of my favourite ones you've put me onto.
I think we might have that might have been getting a couple of plays. But that's all right. That's good. It's a good song. Now, during the break just then, I was having a look at some of my notes on the H.C. Coombs 1945 Full Employment White Paper. And it says here that unemployment is, this is the objective of this white paper. It says unemployment is an evil. Commonwealth and state governments are obliged to and owe Australian people the responsibility to maintain conditions of full employment.
Such a different attitude back then.
It's so different. Now, and they said that unemployment breeds more unemployment, less spending activity, and the opposite is also true. So if people aren't unemployed, it stimulates the economy.
I think the general public understood this as well as the bureaucrats. No, because they'd just seen the war and they'd just seen everybody be employed.
Yeah, you know, and if somebody was unemployed, people would, back then, back during the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, they go, oh, well, you know, we've got to help you out, mate. We'll help you out and we'll get you back on your feet and we'll get you a job. I'm saying mate because it was a male-dominated workforce back then and it's not so much now.
That's
so,
okay, mate.
So, thanks, mate. Oh, mate. So it was good, but now it's far more inclusive than that and there's a lot more options, which is good. But we should, of course, be working less. Like, underpinning this whole thing, we have to remember that mm-hmm. with automation and mm-hmm. with computerisation, we should all be working 30-hour weeks.
We should be. What happened to the so-called leisure dividend?
Yeah. So, you know, like, you factor in the leisure dividend, the fact that we should be working less, spreading the I don't know, the benefits of I hate using the word production. Mm. There's that song by Cable Ties, I am not a production unit. which
I used to get quite offended as an unemployed person being called an idle resource.
An idle resource, yeah. You know, like
these economists, they do use that language, but, you know, you go with it because you know that they mean that they're just trying to describe how the economy works.
You know, there's more to it than that. You have to consider people's well-being, which is important, you know.
Speaking of well-being.
Yeah, well, because we've seen a touch of this over in New Zealand with Jacinda Ardern, and this is the real translation from an economy is what does it do for its members? How does it work for mm-hmm. as a member of society? Is your economy working for you, or are you being exploited?
Well, as it happens, I did come across the fact that Jim Chalmers, who is our current treasurer since the election back in May. He, just after the election, the Australian Financial Review reported that he was personally keen on the New Zealand-style wellbeing budget.
Excellent.
And before we might consider what he might mean by that and what New Zealand is doing, let's just have a listen to the treasurer, the then treasurer back in February 2020, Josh Frydenberg. Let's have a listen to him reacting to Jim Chalmers talking about a well-being budget.
I'm sure it's very sympathetic.
Well, yesterday we heard that the member for Rankin's alternative to a balanced budget was a well-being budget, Mr. Speaker. Now, I want you to picture this.
Then Treasurer with the Coalition Government, Josh Frydenberg, who lost his seat to the Teal independent candidate Monique Ryan in the 2022 federal election.
I want you to picture this alternative. The member for Rankin is about to deliver his first well-being budget. He walks in barefoot into the chamber, Mr. Speaker. Robes are flowing. Incense is burning, Mr. Speaker. Beads in one hand and speech in the other hand, Mr. Speaker. Gone are the seats, gone are the benches, Mr. Speaker, and in their place, Meditation mats for all, Mr. Speaker. Meditation mats for all. And the member for Rankin stands up to address the chamber to announce that his wellbeing tour has gone national. Hugs for all, Mr. Speaker.
Josh Frydenberg, ridiculing the idea of a wellbeing budget as proposed by Jim Chalmers, who was in opposition government at the time and is the current Treasurer of Australia.
It just speaks volumes, doesn't it? You know, the idea to a neoliberal like Josh Frydenberg that an economy is for anything other than to make rich people richer, to make
grow the GDP,
to stimulate greed, and that it might actually have some benefit for the whole community is so foreign to him that he can only resort to ridicule when presented with the idea.
Mm-hmm. It's very typical, isn't it? Typical of how the progressive economic ideas get ridiculed. And I know the MMT, as they often quote that little saying that says, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win.
Yeah, well, good. We're on the way to winning then.
Maybe
yeah.
We're on the way.
But this is what we all need to recognise is that an economy is a distribution of resources. A macroeconomic situation is when the resources of a community are distributed in a fair and sustainable way. Mm. And we have moved so far from that concept. I'm not even sure if we've even. I think the whole idea of sustainability is something that is new because as we have a growing population in the world and resources are becoming strained, this is something that we're dealing with for the first time, that we're living beyond our means. Mm. But the idea that you could have a reasonable and equitable distribution at a basic level.
Yeah, well, it's a huge change in how you frame how you do your budget. And I'll be very curious to see what happens in October when Jim Chalmers, who was very keen to do a wellbeing budget at one point, whether he's going to go ahead and do that. Because what you're doing is instead of talking about targeting how much money you're spending, and in a worst case scenario, you're doing the totally ridiculously bad economically managing thing of targeting a surplus. Yep. Instead of doing that, you're targeting what they call outcomes, which promote wellbeing. And so with New Zealand, what they were doing in their 2022 budget, they were prioritising five outcomes. And if we got time, I'll just go through them quickly. So the first one was a just transition to a low-emission economy. How about that?
Tick.
Tick.
Big tick.
So that's what we're all hoping for out of our economies at the moment. And another really interesting one that they were prioritising was support for physical and mental health well-being. And I thought that's really interesting because now if we're actually targeting that, what we're going to be thinking about is, for example, lifting people out of poverty. We're going to be thinking about funding the health system properly. We're going to be thinking of funding drug and alcohol rehabilitation. We're going to be thinking of doing better staff to patient ratios in aged care. All of the things that enhance well-being.
Yeah.
So that's huge to have that as an objective. Another one was that they want to enable all people to benefit from new technologies and lifting productivity and wages through innovation. Now, that sounds like a lot of bureaucratic speak, but we were talking earlier about how you can use immigration to lower wages, and they're actually talking about using technology to raise wages.
To skill up your workforce and to give people access to the tools that they need to work.
And they're talking about lifting productivity because one thing that companies will do is that they will exploit workers in order to maintain their profits rather than lift productivity. So this flies in the face of the whole neoliberal agenda. Another one that they talk about in New Zealand is lifting Maori and Pacific people's incomes, skills and opportunities. How about that? Right in the centre of your budget.
Right, as putting your Indigenous population fair and square on the thing. Well, you know, yeah, there's a lot to be done here on that thing. Now, what was the fifth one?
So we've also got the last one was, oh, reducing child poverty.
Reducing, which is just a given. Like, you just give that. Now, look, this whole wellbeing thing is a whole show in itself, Anne, and I think you've been speaking to Dr. Phil Lawn at some stage previous, and we're going to have a show about this in the forthcoming, in the next month or two. And Dr. Phil is just brilliant. He's just lovely as a person, for starters.
We do like our Phil Lawn.
If you ever had a person who knows about well-being, it's Dr. Phil Lawn, but he's also studied this in great detail.
Yes, well, Phil Lawn is one of the very few people, or very few economists, who are looking at the economy through the lens of MMT, and they also are an ecological economist. So he's putting those two things together in the way he talks about the economy. And he had some very interesting things to say about what you were just talking about, which is, what is the relationship between a well-being economy and a sustainable economy? Because the two things are not necessarily the same.
Yeah. Yep.
So
I'm looking forward to that. Listen to Dr. Phil. I've heard him speak a couple of times before. Always enjoy it. But we're running out of time, Anne. We've got to make some room, I think, at some stage for Mafalda, which is coming up next.
Well, we better get out of here, Kevin.
Okay. It was good to finish off the previous show with this show. We touched on the white paper. I want to go back to the white paper, but let's get out of here and make room for
time.
Vicky. Catch you. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Unemployed Workers Fight Back.
Join us the second and fourth Friday of each and every month as part of the Sewer Show on 3CR.
Listen to this show as a podcast by going to 3cr.org.au.
We thank all our guests, and I thank you, Anne.
And I thank you, Kevin.
Oh no, the pleasure was all mine.
Oh no, Kevin, the pleasure was all mine.
You mean all the pleasure was yours?
Kevin, I think I took all the pleasure on this one.
Well, if you took all the pleasure, that means there's no pleasure for me at all. I quite enjoyed myself. So if you've got all the pleasure, then what, I had no pleasure?
I think we should share the pleasure.
Well, we're going to have to share the pleasure because, you know, I don't mind you having pleasure. That's great. So you have as much pleasure as you like, but don't take all the pleasure.
Well, it was very pleasurable. So I'm glad that it was pleasurable for you and it was pleasurable for me. I think we've got a multiplier of pleasure here.
It's doubly pleasurable. So if it was pleasurable for you in the first place and it was pleasurable for me, well, it's twice as pleasurable as before. That's a good thing.
Double pleasure. What could go wrong?
Nothing could go wrong. Well, we agree?
I think we could agree to agree.
Agree.
I'm another teenage suicide in a street that has no trees.
I am the one.